and you can use the steps as a seat. Okay, this is, I'll let you introduce yourself. I'm not even going to speak your name. You speak it.
I am Paul Shatskin, once upon a time known as the professor.
Still known as a professor.
Well, but only on Fuser.net do they still call me the professor.
Really?
And I am the author of two biographies of obscure 20th century scientists. Philo T. Farnsworth, and all he ever did was invent the television. And T. Townsend Brown. And after 20 years of research, we're still not really sure what he did. But it's an interesting story. So I'm going to read to you tonight two selections. It's a presentation in two parts. The first part is the foreword to the new edition of The Boy Who Invented Television, which I released this year. And then the second part will be passages from both books where I think they tie together. But before I begin, first of all, on the screen here is a photograph which I'm using as the frontispiece to this new foreword to The Boy Who Invented Television, and I'll talk about that a little bit in the talk, so I wanted to have it on the screen. It's Earthrise from Apollo 8 in December of 1968, and those of us who were around then will remember what a profound moment that was. Yeah. And the quote, "The universe is filled with magical things patiently waiting for our wits to get sharper," is from a science fiction writer from the 1920s named Eden Philpotts. And that is the opening epigraph of The Man Who Mastered Gravity. So before I begin, I just want to say, thank you, Frank.
I think he's outside jabbering.
No, Frank is right here.
Yeah, okay, I don't know. You never know who the hell's in here.
All right. Here beginneth part one, the foreword to the 2023 edition of The Boy Who Invented Television. It begins with a quotation, "It's an odd mission, but this seems to be my destiny in life." I tossed that line off to a friend in March of 2023. At the time, I was nearing the release of my second book, The Man Who Mastered Gravity, the biography of a mercurial figure named Thomas Townsend Brown. That book is now available from booksellers worldwide. Some guys fly to the moon. Some guys start a company and make $1 billion. Some guys become doctors or lawyers. That's what my parents always expected of me. Some guys become auto mechanics, bakers, candlestick makers, or Indian chiefs. Some guys become writers and publish dozens of books. And some guys, well, so far I've written and published 2 books. It has only taken me 50 years. Nobody is ever going to accuse me of being prolific. At this point, with far more of my life behind me than ahead, maybe the most I can hope for is having forged and hung on to my own vision of what this universe of magical things offers us here on Earth. I believe that vision is the thread that ties these 2 books together and justifies the time and effort it has taken to put them both in the world at this time. The earliest iteration of The Boy Who Invented Television traces back to research I started in the stacks of the UCLA Research Library in 1975. At the time, I was living and working on the fringes of the film and TV industry in Hollywood and harbored aspirations of producing a movie for television about the boy who invented it. Movies for television were a thing in the 70s. In the summer of 1975, I flew from L.A. to Salt Lake City to meet the widow and 2 sons of Philo T. Farnsworth, who had died 4 years earlier at the age of just 64. Almost 50 years later, television, the most powerful storytelling medium ever invented, has yet to explore the story of its own unlikely origins. Go figure. Had I known then what an obsession I'd embarked on, perhaps I would have taken a different course. Bartender, maybe? When I met her in 1975, Penn Farnsworth was beginning work on a memoir and biography of her late husband that was not published until 1990. She and her heirs granted me the rights to make the movie based on that book, but insisted on reserving the rights for a book to herself. I researched the stories they told me. With the material I found in those stacks at UCLA, I corroborated their version of events and the titanic struggle between an individual genius and a monolithic corporation that left one of the most notable scientists of the 1930s in total obscurity by the 1970s. I published a treatment of the story in an obscure periodical in 1977 in observance of the 50th anniversary of the first successful electronic television transmission on September 7th, 1927. I helped Pam finish her book in 1989, but I didn't have an opportunity to publish a book of my own until 2002, just in time for the 75th anniversary. With one book to my credit, I embarked on my new career as a biographer of obscure 20th century scientists. The only question was, what obscure 20th century scientist would I write about next? That question was answered when an anonymous email showed up in my inbox in July of 2002, just a few weeks before The Boy Who Invented Television was set loose in the world. Here is where I first heard the name T. Townsend Brown. The anonymous email said, quote, T. Townsend Brown was another inventor who is forgotten and swept under the rug. Science in the late 1950s said what he did was against physical law, yet the government classified the work. A bunch of government contractors, both American and foreign, have been working on it ever since. So where did all the R&D go? If you go out in the desert, about 125 miles southwest of Las Vegas, at night, you will see an object flying around in the distance with a blue haze around it. That's where it went, unquote. Okay, long story short, the sequel that I started writing in 2003 was released last spring in 2023. The Boy Who Invented Television finally had its sequel in The Man Who Mastered Gravity. So, one book every 20 to 25 years. With two books now in circulation, people keep asking me, what are you going to write next? Let's see. I'm 72 years old now, and I publish a book every 25 years. Do the math. Like I said, an odd mission, an unlikely destiny. Now, here is what I consider to be the single most profound photograph ever taken. Countless millions, probably billions, maybe trillions of photos have been taken of individual humans since the first daguerreotypes were exposed and printed in the 19th century. But Earthrise is the first photo in which all of humanity was captured in a single frame, suspended in a vast cosmic void. Philo Farnsworth was always intrigued with the possibility of traveling in that cosmic void. In 1926, as newlyweds Pam and Philo rode a ferry across the San Francisco Bay under a moonless sky, he pointed toward the stars and confided his ambition to go out there someday. That such a thing was even remotely ponderable in the 1920s is testimony to the vision that Philo Farnsworth shared with the likes of Albert Einstein. Farnsworth arrived on planet Earth in 1906, a year after Albert Einstein reshaped human understanding with his radical ideas about the elastic qualities of time and space and the equivalence of energy and matter. All of the work that Farnsworth did over the course of his lifetime was born of that new cosmology. As mundane an appliance as it sometimes seems, that cosmology cleared the path for the advent of television. You may be watching The Real Housewives of Transylvania, but that transmission is coming to you courtesy the most advanced concepts the human mind has ever pondered. There is still a tendency in some circles to dismiss Farnsworth's contribution to the inventing of television as just one among many. I cringe every time I read that Philo Farnsworth was just one of countless pioneers who made television possible. Such a reduction does a great service to the arc of human capacity and achievement. The way I see it, Farnsworth's first patents express a breakthrough of epic proportions. The sketch for a television camera tube that 14-year-old Philo Farnsworth drew for his high school science teacher in 1922 embodies the very first paper that Albert Einstein published in that miracle year of 1905. By introducing a particle theory of light, Einstein's articulation of the photoelectric effect laid the foundation for all the quantum physics that came after it. But few today remember that that is the discovery for which Einstein won his Nobel Prize in 1921. It seems obvious. It's near now a century later, but at the time when Farnsworth wrapped Einstein's first discovery in a vacuum tube, he achieved a breakthrough in what humans could do to focus and steer quantum forces and particles. The image dissector tube rendered obsolete all the spinning wheel attempts at television that had preceded it, and it made possible everything that has come since, from ultra-high-definition wall-sized flat-panel displays to these smartphones that fit in our pockets. Someday, the cosmology first expressed by Albert Einstein and embodied in Farnsworth's ideas for electronic television will carry mankind beyond the threshold that Bill Anders captured through the window of Apollo 8 in 1968. I suspect that some of Philo Farnsworth's most closely held secrets will be along for that ride. I only came to that conclusion after spending another two decades trying to make sense of the material that earlier this year finally found its way into that long-awaited sequel, The Man Who Mastered Gravity. But the second book is not so much a sequel, as the two books together are of a single piece. Together, they circle two advanced technologies that remain tantalizingly out of the reach of earthbound humans, fusion energy and gravity control. I don't want to say much more about that here in the context of the first book. You've got a book to read, and then I hope you'll be sufficiently intrigued to read another. Like I said, it's an odd destiny. Now, here endeth part one of tonight's reading. I will now proceed with part two, which draws on the material found in the two books. I've been thinking a lot lately about how, where, and when these two stories dovetail together. I've only asked myself that question a gazillion times over the past 20 years. In the course of one podcast interview back in June, I found myself, finally, beginning to articulate the point where these two stories are in perfect congruence. First, I'm going to cite a passage from the Townsend Brown biography and then a synchronous story from the Philo Farnsworth bio. In The Man Who Mastered Gravity, there's a marvelous scene from the spring of 1927 when Townsend Brown is courting Josephine, the young woman who would become his wife. By the time he took her sailing on Ohio's Buckeye Lake, he had found a receptive enough audience for his unorthodox ideas to be comfortable expressing one of his most cherished visions. This is an excerpt from chapter 14. As their little sailboat skimmed across the surface of the lake, Josephine tried to lighten the mood. "Okay, Mr. Smarty, if you could travel through time, what do you think we will find in the future? Will there still be wars? What will become of mankind in the future?" The young dreamer, with the tiller in one hand and the mainsheet in the other, knew it was time to share the vision he had seen in his dreams. "We will just sail away," he said. "What do you mean?" "Someday, men will travel in space just as easily as we are sailing now. Great ships will silently push away from the earth just as easily as this sailboat pushed away from the dock." Josephine closed her eyes and tried to imagine their little boat sailing across the void of space. In her heart, she knew she was hearing something not only strange and fantastic, but also true. Remember, this is a story from the mid-1920s, roughly the time when Robert Goddard was conducting his very first experiments with the sort of rocket propulsion that would eventually blast men into orbit and off to the moon. Rocketry was barely out of its cradle, but already Townsend Brown was dismissing it, as he would describe it in the years hence, as brute and awkward force. The idea that Townsend shared with Josephine demonstrates that just as necessity is the mother of invention, likewise invention is the mother of new horizons. Once you begin to see things differently, the experience that follows will open more new possibilities in the realm of the unorthodox. As Townsend Brown envisioned great vessels simply pushing away from the earth, Philo Farnsworth nurtured a similar vision toward his unique experience. In the summer of 1926, Farnsworth was still a year away from delivering television into the world, but already he could sense what the future had in store. And like Townsend Brown, he expressed that vision to his wife while they were sailing on a boat. Farnsworth's laboratory in San Francisco was at the foot of Telegraph Hill in San Francisco. The cottage he shared with his new wife, Pam, was across the bay in Berkeley. They often spent their days in the lab together. Pem contributed drawings and diagrams for the patents and helped with administrative chores, while Phil and Pem's brother, Cliff Gardner, began fabricating tubes and circuits. As described in Chapter 4 of The Boy Who Invented Television, quoting from the book now, the first few months in San Francisco were a heady and romantic time for the newlywed Farnsworths. One night in particular stood out in Pem's memory, a brisk, moonless night in January when she and Phil were taking the late ferry back to their cottage on Derby Street. They'd walked out on the deck, and Phil pointed out some of the constellations and planets he had learned from his father. Then, out of the blue, Phil said, "Someday, I'm going to build a spaceship and go out there, and I hope that you'll want to go with me." A chill ran down Pam's spine. She'd never been off the ground, never even been up in an airplane. Now, suddenly the man she had just married, a man she knew was quite capable of achieving any fanciful dream he imagined, was proposing to take her into the infinite darkness of space. The very thought of it scared her witless. She was silent for a full minute until Phil asked her, "Does that scare you?" "Yes," Pam answered, "it scares me to death, but I'm not going to let you go off into a space without me. I get goosebumps just thinking about it. But I suppose I'd rather die with you in space than live on Earth without you." "That's my girl," Phil said with a smile. "That's what I wanted to hear. But you can relax. We've got a lot to do before we could take on such a project, and it may take longer than we think to make something commercial out of television." That's the end of the quote from the book. From the work he did over the next decade to make something commercial out of television, Farnsworth learned to do with quantum mechanics more than any man alive at the time. And from his novel vacuum tubes came the inspiration for a device that could bottle a star. And from that conception came his own unique sense of what the future might have in store. In the middle of the 20th century, as mankind challenged gravity with ever more powerful rockets, Farnsworth expressed his vision for space travel using the analogy of a pineapple and a pea. With rocket propulsion, Farnsworth would say, the first Earthlings in space needed a launch vehicle the size of a pineapple in order to lift a payload the size of a pea. Just picture the Saturn V rocket that took Apollo astronauts to the moon. There's a Volkswagen-sized spacecraft sitting atop a 40-story tall fuel tank, and much of that fuel was burned just getting the rest of the fuel off the launch pad. With fusion energy as the source of propulsion, Farnsworth believed that ratio would be reversed. He imagined that a fusion-powered launch vehicle the size of a pea would one day lift a payroll the size of a pineapple. In the last chapters of The Boy Who Invented Television, Farnsworth speaks of small fusion-powered rockets gently lifting enormous payloads into orbit. Once in orbit, fusion-powered spacecraft could make it to Mars on as much nuclear fuel as could be contained, stored in a tank the size of a fountain pen. This is where the two stories intersect. Gently lifting enormous payloads sure sounds to me a lot like silently pushing away from the Earth, just as easily as a sailboat pushes away from the dock. Farnsworth may not have been thinking in terms of synthetic gravity any more than Townsend Brown was thinking in terms of synthetic stars. But the two ideas fit together perfectly. The electrical potential of Philo Farnsworth's fusion reactor is precisely what Townsend Brown needed to produce the artificial gravity in an engine not much larger or heavier than the V8 in my Mustang. And a vessel that can just sail away sounds like a pea propelling a pineapple to me. Taken together, these two stories suggest that mankind has come so far along in his technical progress that he has reached a threshold beyond which lies the universe of magical things that even Eden Philpotts speaks of in the epigraph that begins The Man Who Mastered Gravity. Then comes the daunting question. If we have reached that threshold, why can't we cross it? With that quandary, here endeth tonight's reading. Thank you for your time and attention. Okay, who wants to ask me questions I don't know the answers to?
Wait a minute. you were talking about why can't we cross that threshold, and I say it is physics. we don't have the physics or the right ideas to cross it. That's the only reason.
Okay.
And I have no solution to that. All I know is it's wrong. We're headed the wrong way in any number of ways, but who am I?
Well,
I'm learning.
Would you have believed in 1890 that we'd be splitting atoms in 1945?
Based on
what we knew in 1890.
1890.
Right. Okay. So
That was a lucky donkey. There was no physics involved there.
What was a lucky donkey?
Henri Becquerel. He discovered a rock was throwing out rays that we had around for billions of years. And why were these rays coming out? Do you think the physics leaped on that? No, it was the chemist. And the physicist didn't even get involved until 1910 or so, trying to figure out what the hell is going on, while the chemists were busy refining radium and doing all these other things. And so finally the physicists got involved because they still was mysterious. Hell, remember in 1890, Lord Kelvin had proven that the sun was a ball of carbon that had been burning since the biblical year 5900 and something.
Right, and we all knew until sometime in the 19th century that the world was 6,000 years old.
Yeah.
So, ladies and gentlemen, I ask the question, why can't we cross the threshold? And I give you the answer, Richard Hall.
I thought we could do that. Fusion was a goal until I did it.
Mm-hmm.
And saw how ridiculously easy it is to do and how virtually it is impossible to do in a controlled manner. Yet fission was controlled within 3 years after we blew up a 250,000 people. We had a working nuclear reactor.
And that is why the universe is patiently waiting for our wits to grow sharper.
Yeah, well, I say it's going to take another Becquerel, another lucky donkey to stumble on to something. Yeah. Going to be some lucky donkey.
Okay, who has another question I can't answer?
Why are we giving the wrong name to antimatter when in reality it is reverse polarity matter?
Gee, did I say anything about antimatter during the course of this talk?
Fusion and crossing the threshold.
Well,
that's a philosophical.
A lot of our limitations are due to our vocabulary, because that expresses the capacity for understanding. So maybe we need better terminology to try to wrap ourselves around this stuff.
There was a recent experiment that showed that antimatter is subject to gravitational forces. I think that they were using
anti-gravity there.
Right.
Yeah. Do we assume antimatter also has mass?
Yes.
Then there must be some gravitational component.
Because it has kinetic energy,
Remember, folks, I'm not a physicist. I only play one on the internet.
Then another. I wonder if anybody in here has the ability to show how reverse polarity neutrons can exist.
No, it's an anti-neutron. It's not reverse polarity because it's neutral. If you reverse neutral, you're neutral.
No, the neutrons have some particles. The subparticles themselves will have both charges. So the subparticles will be arranged in a certain order. For reverse polarity, it would mean that the order that they're arranged would be reverse. And that is my view of how you could have anti-neutrons.
All right.
I'll go along with that. So,
what time does your talk start?
What?
So what time does your talk start?
Yeah, do you have a talk tonight?
Oh, okay.
Oh,
okay,
I
so we're safe.
Yeah.
Okay, but at any rate,
is my time
any
up
other questions regarding fusing and crossing a threshold into tomorrow? It's basically an energy question, isn't it? Think about it. That's the one thing we need is energy if we're going to, you know, go forward.
I think the answer is more in the wits growing sharper.
The wits growing sharper. I don't think we're not displaying a whole lot of wits here. You know?
Hence the epigraph.
Yeah. So,
all right.
Well, I have a question. So, did Townsend Brown have any inventions that we would be familiar with that persist to today?
Ionic wheel.
Yeah, believe it or not, do you remember? Were you around? I don't know how old you are, but back in the 80s and 90s, there were commercials for the Sharper Image Ionic Breeze air purifier.
Okay.
That is a Townsend Brown invention.
He didn't make a dime off of it.
But there's a story in the book about how he kind of turned the patents over to a fellow named Jim Lee, and there's some testimony from Jim Lee in the book, and Jim Lee is the one who actually refined what Townsend Brown had invented and incorporated that in what he sold to the Sharper Image. But his patents, Jim Lee's patents, refer to Townsend Brown's patents as the prior art.
Okay.
Yeah. And if any of you are familiar with the lifters that you see on YouTube and stuff, they are also based on Townsend Brown's Blifeld Brown effect, it's called. And they use the same principle as the ionic breeze.
That guy right there brought a giant lifter here, and it lifted off the bench.
Yeah. Total electrical propulsion.
Yep.
Didn't he also do the electrostatic speaker?
Yeah, that was another iteration of the electrokinetic effect in the lifter. And there are stories in the book about these giant wall-sized speakers that they built that had no moving parts. So any loudspeaker that you're familiar with now has moving, pulsing parts. This had no moving parts. It simply moved the air through an electrokinetic process. And while I have not heard one myself, the testimony at the time was that the sound was incredibly bright and clear.
Where's Larry Hofstedler? He's outdoors. He brought electrostatic speakers here that he had made, set up on the fence.
But those are electrostatic speakers. These were electrokinetic. It was it's something different.
I've never seen or heard of those.
Yeah. Made it to the marketplace. Yeah. But the same technology that runs the ionic breeze, if you run the circuits differently, can be a loudspeaker.
Anything else?
All right. Well,
okay.
Again, thank
Thanks
you all
again.
For your time
Great.
And attention.
And now, is Dave ready to give us a little chat? Dave Hamrich, go ahead. He is he's the head guy who owns, operates, and makes a living off of Metallium on the website, metallium.com, right?
Elementsales.com.
Elementsales.com.
I couldn't afford the Metallium.